Committee on Consumer Protection for the Oregon State Legislature. Today is Monday, February 5th, 2007. Today we'll be having two public hearings, House Bill 2224 and 2113. And I'd like to start with House Bill 2224. And I would like to now open the public hearing on House Bill 2224. And if we could get a representative from the Department of Consumer and Business Services to come forward, that would be helpful. And Steve, why don't you give us a little preview of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2224 permits the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to specify categories of insurance for which the Director need not review individual policy forms. If the Director finds that the Interstate Insurance Product Regulation Commission offers similar or better protections than those in state law.
Thank you, Joel. If you'll state your name for the record and give us a view of the bill from the perspective of your agency.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ario. I'm the administrator with the Insurance Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 2224. It's one of our pre-session filed bills. It deals with the product approval function of the Insurance Division, and that's a very important function. In virtually every line of insurance, we have what's called prior approval authority, meaning that insurance form here, policy form, is the basic contract that's made between the insurance company and the consumer. We approve those before they're used in our marketplace to make sure that they comply with state laws and that they're fair to the consumer. And that's a very important consumer protection. In many cases, there are issues unique to the state in that approval process. So, for instance, with property and casualty insurance, auto, homeowner, also with health insurance, there are things about the Oregon market that require specific review for our marketplace. There are reasons why when somebody moves from another state to Oregon, they give up their auto, their homeowner, their health insurance, and have to have a policy here because circumstances are different here. There are, however, other insurance products that don't differ state by state. And so they're the same product whether you buy them here or whether you bought them in a prior state. If you're moving into the state, if you move into the state, you keep those kinds of products. And so with those kinds of products, questions arise as to whether it is efficient to have all 50 states conducting their own independent review process. The bill before you today proposes to address one of those areas of redundancy in the 50-state review process, and that is life insurance, annuities, and disability insurance. Just those three types of insurance are affected by this bill, and what the bill proposes to do is look to a solution that a majority of our fellow states have adopted, which is the Interstate Compact. States have recognized what I just said about these products and said it really isn't efficient. There are better uses of our resources, precious state resources, staff resources, than to have all of us doing the same reviews 50 different times on essentially the same products. So they've created this entity called the Interstate Compact. 29 states now belong. The fact sheet lists only 28 of them because Michigan has joined very recently, and that compact was created, operationalized as of January 1st of this year in Washington, D.C. Now, it's still very much in its early stages, hasn't done any product approval yet, hasn't officially adopted any product standards yet, is still wrestling with fundamental issues about a consumer advisory committee, an industry advisory committee, and those sorts of things. So there's still a lot of questions about the compact, and that's why our bill, I'd call it a compact light bill. We are not proposing to be the 30th state to join the compact. We are instead proposing that we look carefully at the compact as it develops. Somebody used the phrase of pig in a poke still with the compact in its current stage of development. So instead of becoming part of the compact, we propose a go slow, incremental approach to the compact, which is to say that we will watch the compact as it develops and look at particular categories of products. And within life insurance, annuities, and disability insurance, there are multiple different categories of products. There are deferred annuities, immediate annuities, there are variable annuities, fixed annuities. There's all kinds of different types of life insurance these days. We would look at each the product standards for specific categories of products, and if we determined that that for that particular category of products, the compact process was substantially as protective of consumers as our process and our standards taken as a whole, and that's a very important part of the bill. I direct you to the paragraph on the second page of my testimony towards the bottom, the second bullet there. The standard is that the director determines that the approval process gives policyholders substantially the same protection as, or better protection than, the review process available under current Oregon law with respect to review procedures, product standards, the nature of the insurance product, and the consumer needs served by the product. Each of those is important. You might have good standards with the compact. You might say those standards are as good as the Oregon standards, but then when you look to the review procedures, you see that instead of having a prior approval like we have, they have some other kind of review process. That would be a second issue under the bill. And then you also have to look to the nature of the particular product, what market it serves, and the consumer needs that are served by the product. So all of that would be taken into account, but if it all came out that the standards under the compact were substantially as protective, then this bill would give us the authority through a rulemaking process to essentially give deference to those standards in Oregon and say that products that have been approved through that process are approved in Oregon, assuming the carrier is licensed here meets other basic requirements like that. That's the purpose of the bill, we think it's a kind of win-win situation. If the compact turns out to be a good entity, at least on some products, we get the advantage of that. We can allocate, and I think this is a particularly important point for us, it's come up in several of my discussions with members. There are a lot of other issues involved with life insurance, annuities, and disability insurance products, and probably to my mind, the most important issue these days is the suitability of the product. There are thousands of different products out there. We want Oregonians to have a lot of choices. These products are competing in the financial market these days with other kinds of financial investment products. And I've had calls even from legislators. I'm talking back and forth with one senator now who has a product he wants us to approve because his brokers told him it's a good product for his portfolio. But there's a second concern with all these products, which is what's appropriate for somebody. One person may not be appropriate for others. And right now, because we have so many resources tied up in the product approval end, we don't have as much resources as I would like looking at whether these products are sold suitably, particularly to the elderly, particularly with annuities. And so if a bill like this were to pass and we could get the advantage of the compact on some products, we would then have the ability to reallocate resources to looking at what I think is the more important consumer protection issue oftentimes, which is the product that's good for some people, suitable for the particular person it was sold to. So I would urge, we do have amendments, as I noted. I believe they're still in drafting. I don't know if the committee has seen them back then. So the two things we said, the most important parts of the amendments are, one, to clarify that only the compact, it can be the basis for one of these rulemaking hearings. In the original bill, it talked about potentially other types of multi-state processes, but we limited it to the compact in the bill. And then secondly, we sunset the bill in 4 years. Again, it's a kind of compact light. It's a go-slow approach, but it's not probably a long-term solution. And after 4 years, we want to look at what the success or lack of success in this bill is, and then consider whether to join the compact, not join it, make a decision based on, by then the compact will be fully operational, have been operational for many years. Those are the main amendments that we would recommend be adopted to the bill, and we urge the committee support for the bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. could you maybe walk us through how you determine if their procedures are good enough, if their products are good enough? How would you do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, the first step would be to look at the product standards themselves. And this enterprise is already underway for us because our people have been participating in the discussions about the development of the national standards. And so we've been looking at various products as they develop to determine what are our standards today versus what are the compact standards. And for it's a complicated business, so for a lot of the products, the standards run to, you know, 20, 30 pages or more. So we've been trying to do a lineup of and compare product by product, partly because as the states get together and talk about this, my experience of it has been it tends to raise the standards, and we hear about new issues that we hadn't had in our product standards before, and then we look to whether in Oregon law we could have those standards, and based on that, we've adopted already some new standards that are allowed under our laws that have come to our attention through the compact. But that would be the first step, is to literally have a chart that compares the product standards in the compact to our product standards for a given product. If that looked to be favorable to the consumer, then we take the next step, which would be, what is the review process? Who does that process for the compact? There are various ways this review can be conducted, and we'd look at the review process and determine whether the review process there is the same as ours or as good for consumers as ours. And then we'd finally consider the nature of the product and the consumer needs. I think that latter point about the nature of the product and the consumer needs is in there because it's particularly important for disability insurance, because there may be more issues there with differences that you might think are significant state to state. The compact itself also has a fourth category that we didn't propose in this bill, which is long-term care insurance, and that gets closer to health insurance and the delivery systems of the state, so we didn't even propose that one. But we would have that set of issues, I think, not so much with life and annuity products, because they really are the same risk nationally, but with disability insurance, there may be some issues that you want to look to about the nature of the product. So we'd go through each of those steps, then we'd hold a public hearing, as we do with all of our rulemaking, as we're required to do with all of our rulemaking, to hear from everybody else that might have an opinion on the matter, and then make a decision.
Let's follow up, please, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Riley.
Thank you. And tell me, if you will, how you view this affecting the ability of this body to regulate those kinds of policies.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, it would not affect this body's ability to regulate those products, because you could, whenever you chose to, adopt new consumer protection standards or relax consumer protection standards in this state. That would then play into the review process. If the legislature were, on the one hand, to adopt strong new consumer protection that wasn't in the compact, then in that review process, that would show up, and it would be a situation where the test of the rule wouldn't be met. Conversely, if there were something that today in law blocked adoption of a compact standard and the legislature looked at it and said, we want to relax that, that would then affect the review process the other direction. So the substantive law is left to the Oregon legislature and would be continue to be a factor in these reviews.
Final follow-up, if I may.
Please.
Since you've already described this as a pig in a poke, I don't know how fast they plan to move, but it worries me a little bit that we're looking to give you the permission to use standards of someone who doesn't have any standards yet. And I wonder why we don't just set this aside and look at it next year or year after, when they actually have some standards that we can look at.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, excellent question, probably the most important question from our perspective on the bill. The compact was originally created back in 2002, and a number of states stepped forward at the time. There was no compact in place, and the product development standards really had, that process hadn't been fully engaged. As that's moved forward, there are a lot of product standards that have been adopted by people who are going to be part of the compact that's now operational. So there's a lot of standard material that's out there that we've been looking at, and as that's developed, a number of other states have gotten more comfortable. My partner to the north, for instance, Mike Kreidler, was originally an opponent of the compact because he thought the standards were going to be low common denominator standards, and as he's seen them develop, he took the move in his last legislative session, saying that I've seen enough now to be confident in the process. For us, it becomes a judgment call. The compact is now operational. The legislature may meet next year. My personal preference would be that it would. That makes some of these kind of issues easier, but if it didn't, then we would be out two more years, and then by the time we put the operational rules in place to do this, we'd be out probably three or four more years. And so we thought there's enough development now that before waiting for a full two more years, it seemed like an opportunity. And again, we have a lot of resource that goes into this area, and if we could free up some of that resource, make me happy.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Ario, for your testimony. As a non-member state, would Oregon, relying on the work of the compact, would you have access to all of the information and data that the member states have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, yes, the process has been determined to be public on that score of the development of the product standards, and they are including to this point. Again, the compact is its own sovereign entity. It could decide to change this at some point, but so far the process has been one of inclusion for all the states to participate in the development of standards. A lot of this activity actually goes on through our National Association and National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and the thought is, the hope is, the plan is that the standards that have been developed through that regulatory apparatus will then translate and be adopted by the compact. The one thing we don't have, obviously, as a non-member, is on controversial issues, we don't have a vote and we don't have participation in the actual decision-making. But in terms of access to information, today it's full access, and I believe it will continue to be that way.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ario, do you know if any other states are taking this approach, this compact light approach?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, Florida has had discussion along these lines. I'm not sure exactly where their discussions are at this point. Part of the issue has been, from the insurance industry's perspective, what they really want is federal regulation. Their solution to one-stop shopping is, let's have a federal regulator. They've been somewhat supportive of the compact, as long as it's exactly the same compact for everybody and all of that. And so the industry has generally argued against approaches like ours. We've had a lot of discussion with the industry here. They're obviously not happy with this bill. They think we should go all the way to the compact. But because we've tried to work with them and say we won't get a compact here. Last time I looked at the list, they marked themselves neutral. But that's tended to be where there hasn't been a lot of constituency for that middle ground, because the industry says all or nothing kind of thing on this. And so we're bringing it forward as kind of our solution. I think it's a win-win from the regulator's perspective, but the politics with the industry aren't necessarily favorable. I think that's probably the main reason you haven't seen a lot of this. I thought they would oppose this proposal, frankly, and took some work to try to get them neutral.
Thank you.
Representative Galizio.
Mr. Ario, streamlining is useful until it has a negative impact on quality. And so I'm wondering what criteria would be used to measure the effectiveness or lack thereof. In other words, I know there's an amendment for a four-year sunset. I mean, what criteria are you looking at to see that, you know, quality of analyses not being impacted negatively while you go to the streamlining? And how are you going to measure whether or not it's working?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, another good question to which I don't have a simple, foolproof answer. We make these kinds of judgments on a daily basis as we look at products and look at different things that are filed and whether they're protective of the consumer or not. We would exercise the same kind of judgment. In a lot of cases, it's fairly clear-cut where the consumer interest lies on a given product. But in other cases, as your question anticipates, it's not as easy, and it does involve, I think, recognizing our expertise to make those kinds of judgments. One point I'd make, I think, that's probably important here: before there was a compact, the regulators talking about this issue recognized that there is, you know, it's a different situation with life products where the same product is reviewed 50 times over, that we ought to try to do something about that. The first attempt to do something about that was to say, why don't we get all the states together and create a master list, and then we'll identify for each product which things are different by state, so we could make the review process easier that way. We went down that road for about a year and a half, and it just became so cumbersome because, again, we're talking about 20 or 30 pages of standards for individual products that particular approach just didn't work, which is why, in our view here, trying to do this, you know, standard by standard and wrestling with the legislature on each of those is it wouldn't be practical to solve the problem. And so we came to this solution of take them as a whole, look at them. Not only won't only be our opinion, I'm pretty sure the industry will come in and always say it's as good, and the consumer groups will come in and sometimes say it is and sometimes not, and we'll have those discussions.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee?
I have a question.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask you, how is the compact funded, and are there any costs associated with the light path? And sort of to follow up on Representative Bonici's question, did anybody take the light path to get there? You answered the question about Florida looking at that, but... That's my
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, no, nobody's, so far the 29 states that have adopted the compact have all adopted the full compact. So no state's done that yet. Costs associated here, there wouldn't be, there would be some reduction of cost for us, obviously, if we approved something as meeting substantial consumer protection standards in this area. But one of the reasons I wanted to bring up the point about reallocating resources is that we have different priorities in this area, and so I don't want to give the impression that if we did this, it's a streamlined measure that would allow us to reduce a couple staff positions or something. I think it would be a wash because we would be looking more carefully at the suitability issues than we can right now. In terms of how the compact itself is funded, it's going to be on product fees, filing fees, which is the common. Our agency is funded generally through dedicated, the insurance division, through a variety of dedicated funds for filing fees and assessments and that sort of thing. In this particular case, the national compact would be funded through filing fees for the products that come through the compact.
Further questions from the committee? Mr. Ariel, I'm kind of wondering, is the structure of this compact formed under any federal statute, or is there any regulation at the federal level for an organization like this?
Chairman Hovey, no. There are ways to create compacts through a federal delegation. This one is by the states up, so to speak. So there's another set of issues associated with that. There were a couple years ago fairly major questions, but a number of legal scholars and others have looked at it, and there are people probably who still disagree, but there haven't been any legal challenges of it. But it's like most compacts, that those kinds of questions still come up, and frankly, that's another set of questions that we'd buy ourselves 4 more years to look at those questions in terms of full membership in the compact. I should point out, for states that have joined the compact, they can undo it, but it takes another legislative act. And as everybody who's been around this building even a few weeks knows, it's a lot easier to pass a law than it is to, I mean, stop a law than pass a law. So the idea of joining the compact and then having to rescind that, you know, is fairly complicated. So, again, we have this go-slow approach, which gives us the advantages of some of the compact, but without the downsides.
So to follow up with that, so I guess my thinking is, who would regulate this? I mean, is it a self-regulating group, or who regulates any kind of action that this group would take, I guess. Or, you know, I'm just kind of wondering where the oversight of this compact is, or where the power rests.
Mr. Chairman, ultimately back with the states. The states ultimately granted the power, and they have the power to take it away. And so at any point, any legislature would have the right to take back that power. In terms of how it functions on a day-to-day basis, there is a governance structure. The compact, it was one of these negotiations like any of these state-by-state power sharing things. Big states have certain representation. The middle states have representation. Smaller states have representation. People are voted on to the board, and the board of the compact, which is composed of the states that are part of it, is the ultimate decision maker for the compact. So there is a governing board from the participating states. That's the day-to-day authority for the compact. But again, it is an entity of state law. It never escapes into some other realm where it's no longer accountable. It's accountable back through the legislative process to the states.
Following up on my own line of questioning here, do we have a legal opinion, or from the Attorney General's point of view, whether our state can, I guess, under our own laws, can constitutionally delegate our authority to a compact like this, or our statutes that we currently have for regulating the insurance industry, can, I guess, is it legal for us to delegate that to a commission such as this?
Representative Holvey, Chairman Holvey, again, that's not what we're proposing today, but were we proposing that today, we have not got an official opinion from the Attorney General. We had these discussions with the representatives of the Attorney General's office back in 2003 when joining the compact was under consideration, and the informal advice we got at that point was that there wouldn't be a legal barrier. But again, that wasn't final legal advice, and had we chosen to go forward at that point, I think we would have sought the legal opinion that you suggest. And so if we did 4 years from now, again, we're not proposing that. That's just something that could be considered at that point. That would probably be a prudent step to take. Because the issues with compacts are complicated. But obviously, we also do belong to a number. And so far, for the 29 states that have joined, there hasn't been any litigation around the issue of the authority. There is a well-established authority generally for compacts, but there's always peculiar. Every compact is different than every other one, and so there could be legal issues at that point. I think there are none. That's another advantage of our approach today. I don't think there are any. We don't know of any legal issues with our approach.
And I think I have one more question for you. Could this compact in approving forms or anything take on a position that would have the effect of reviewing rates, insurance rates?
Chairman Holvey, I don't believe so. You're testing my knowledge of whether that's in the operating documents as an absolute bar or not. In the areas that we're talking about here, life insurance, annuities, and disability insurance, we don't directly regulate rates. There are some areas where we do, some areas where we don't. So these aren't areas where we regulate rates at this point. Anyway, and I don't believe the compact has that authority. And I do know under the compact's operating guidance, there's specific language around the compact not getting involved in the suitability and the sales practice issues. That's fundamentally why state regulators like myself strongly prefer a cooperative arrangement between the states to federal regulation, is that with these kinds of products, if you had one body regulating the products and letting them into the market without some coordination back to the states, the sales practice issues get very very difficult.
Representative Galizio, another question.
Yeah, sorry, I should have come up with this one before, but I was just rereading your the written testimony that you have here. So, and it dovetails with what Representative Riley said. I'm just trying to figure out what is the compelling need for us to do this when, as Representative Riley pointed out, the sort of standards by which we're supposed to measure whether consumers are better protected are really non-existent. I mean, what streamlining, that is the reason. So how is that such a compelling need that we can't wait? I mean, is the status quo that problematic?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, I would say it's problematic. Is it would the world end if we didn't get this bill in this session? No. But what we do today is, I think, probably if we go back, step back from this, because I've been with this issue for a while, when we go up on the Hill, insurance regulators go up on Capitol Hill in Washington, the strongest argument that people on the Hill throw back at the states is, you guys, even on the simplest issue where the products are exactly the same state to state, you have to have 50 separate review processes. Can't you solve that particular problem? So in terms of, you know, thinking about, did this just come out of whole cloth, kind of all of a sudden people said, let's figure out how to delegate some of this authority to a compact? No, it came out of that political problem of the life insurance industry in particular using this as Exhibit A against the efficiency of the state system. And so that's where the idea came from. Originally, that idea by itself wasn't powerful enough for us to propose the compact. It's back to Representative Riley's question, I think, is you're always at stages. Even if we were 4 years from now and we had the compact, there would still be questions about, well, what if they change their standards next year and so forth. So there's always going to be some amount of decision-making here that says we want a coordinated review process. But we brought the bill because we're satisfied that the process is moving in the right direction. I could tell you some things I wish were slightly different, and I think they may be slightly different within 4 years. But we think it's important, as long as there's the check of none of the product standards can be used in Oregon until they've met our test of substantially as protective. And then if you show me something that is substantially as protective and say, is it a good use of state resources for us to be essentially duplicating that effort on a case by case? By the way, we're talking, I think, about 30,000 filings a year. It's a lot of filings. So it's a lot of staff resource that goes into this that I think could be used more effectively elsewhere. So streamline, yes, but it's also, you know, the amount of staff time that goes into the review process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow up on what Representative Galizia was discussing and maybe backtrack to your earlier testimony where you talked about the suitability investigations that could be done if you had the time to free up, and I just would like a little bit of clarification on that, because if you take the wait and see, if we take the wait and see approach, that's more time that you have to spend doing work that's already being done by the compact that you can't spend doing suitability investigation. Is that correct?
Chairman Hovey, Representative Bonamici, that is correct. My colleague Corey Streisinger is over in another hearing room right now testifying about a new variable annuity proposal to strengthen the regulation around suitability around that product. So there are pressing needs in that area. And again, we don't ever ignore problems. So I don't want to tell you that we have no resource going into that problem, but I can tell you that there's less resource than I would like, which is true in a lot of areas of our regulatory authority. This one seems to me to be one in which we are not able to do as much. And the kinds of things that we would do is not simply, right now we basically wait for consumer complaints to come in, and then we follow them up aggressively, and we try to make examples of the cases where our suitability law and insurance is new. It just started in 2005. So we're in the early stages of trying to make examples of certain cases and kind of try to chill out the market with some aggressive actions. But the next step, if we had the resource, would be to do some examinations of companies around the issue, more proactive sort of approach. And right now that possibly we'll figure out a way to do it with this resource still going here, but it would be much easier if we had the resource available to us to do more of that sooner than later. That's the opportunity that I would say is being lost if we don't do this.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? I have just one more. I'm just kind of curious about this whole product review scenario with this compact. Do we have any information about the number of complaints on products that that actually have happened on products that go through this compact, and compare that to products that are complaints on products that the Oregon has specifically approved? And did that make sense?
Mr. Chair, yes, it made sense to me anyway.
Oh, good.
we don't have the data on the compact itself again, because remember, it's still in its formation stages. The data that we have internally about where complaints come from, we get very few comparatively on life insurance. We get about 5,000 complaints a year overall. Auto accidents still number one. Health insurance, rising number of complaints. But life insurance has tended to be around a 10% of the overall agenda, so something like 500 complaints a year. Mm-hmm. And most of those have to do with sales practices or payout practices when there's a death benefit to be paid or something like that. There aren't a lot that have to do with the terms of the contract itself, but there's also a lot of private litigation around those issues, I would suspect, that doesn't come to our attention.
But as far as complaints on the same sorts of insurance procedures or products, the compact itself doesn't have any history of complaints since 2002?
Mr. Chair, again, the idea of the compact started in 2002, but one of the terms of the compact was that it wouldn't become operational until either a majority of states or states representing at least 40% of the total premium volume in the state were part of the compact. So that threshold was not met until there were 10 states that adopted the compact last year. Somewhere in the middle of last year, that threshold was met. So until before that point, states were joining a compact that wasn't going to be formed until enough states had joined it. So we are, when I say forming the stages, that's where we are still. So there isn't that kind of track record on it. I mean, one aspect of this too that's I would draw to your attention is when you look at the 50 state review processes, they don't get a lot of attention from the consumer community, or we rarely get comments on our rate filing process. We're starting to get more on the health insurance side these days, but that process tends to operate as a very technical arm of our operation. I believe myself that the compact, being one national body, is an easier forum in which for broader audiences to have say, and so far that's generally tended to be true. They're watched more carefully by the industry. Always watches whatever we do here, there, and everywhere, but other interests besides the industry are more active watching the compact. This is one thing to watch rather than trying to keep track of 50 state processes. But again, I think for me the whole ball game is, it's a good argument for this in terms of streamlining and in terms of having an efficient resource, but still the whole decision comes down to, for the industry that's enough, for us it's, well, also what are the standards and are they good for consumers? And that's the reason we propose to build the way we do.
Thank you very much for your testimony. It's interesting bill, interesting subject.
Thank you.
There are no further questions from the committee of Mr. Ario. We'll move on with some more testimony. Thank you so much. Dean Cortez and Dave Nelson. I don't see Dave Nelson here. I know I recognize him.
Kent them over at Variable Annuities. They're busy.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's Dean Corchi. Mr. Nelson is tied up. I don't know where he is. He's sick or someplace. You know. For the record, my name's Dean Corchi. I don't have any written testimony. This seemed like kind of a simple little proposal, and sitting listening to you ask these questions of Mr. Ario, it becomes rather complex. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Insurance and Professional Insurance Advisors, which is the professional representation of insurance agents. We feel we have something to say on this. I'm also a 25-year veteran of this business in Eugene. We're very supportive of this compact, and I'd rather put it in a little different perspective than what Joel did. We feel that, quite frankly, if we don't do the compact, the federal government's going to come in and take over the industry. And that's really, I can say maybe it's fear-based, but I think this is a better way to regulate this. Keep in mind what Joel's talking about. It's really starting off with three very specific types of products. Life insurance, disability insurance, and annuities. And shouldn't that product be the same in Connecticut and Kentucky and Oregon? The design of these products is really not so much done state by state. Yeah, the review of it can be, but I think the compact is a way to do that review much more efficiently. I think Mr. Ario really spelled it out. I think if you had choice of resources, if you have a buck here and a buck there, I would really urge you to put the buck in to really watch in on the distribution and how these products are sold. I think that's where the consumer protection is. It's not the product. The product is probably a pretty good product. It's those of us out there in my business that sell this thing that really need better supervision or better something. That's where the bad news and the bad apple in the barrel takes place. So we're here very simply to support this bill. We hope you take positive measure or action on 2224. We'd even move faster, as Joel did mention. I'm not here speaking on behalf of the insurance industry. They have a different view. But as agents, we feel it's really important that we can bring the same products to our customers as you can in New York or Kentucky. And why should we have to have this whole process of separate review? And we feel the compact is a very rational approach to bringing together some collective way to review these products and still having a voice in it, as Mr. Ario's department is very professional in doing this. So we urge your support, and I'd answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Looks like you got off easy.
I did.
Evidently, Jewel answered all our questions.
I think so.
Thank you. Next up, I'd like to have John Mangan and Arthur Towers. Can you come up together? Did I say that right? Mangan? Evidently, he's not here, so Arthur Towers.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers, and I'm the political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Our union is officially neutral on this legislation, but we do share many of the same concerns that have been raised in this hearing so far about the compact. We commend the department for taking a go-slow approach and being cautious about the compact. But nonetheless, this bill is a small step towards the compact. This is an industry that deserves more scrutiny, not less scrutiny. And the quasi-public process that the compact would call for, though, is going to happen 3,000 miles away at best. We have confidence in this administration and the folks at DCBS and the insurance division to do more on enforcement on the sale of product with available resources. But we're nervous about putting something like this into law when future administrations may not have that same diligence when it comes to enforcement. You know, I thought it was interesting that the commissioner referred to the compact as a pig in a poke, and then turned around and urged you to vote for a pig in a poke light. That I hope you hesitate and think carefully about before you proceed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Tower? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And Rick Bennett.
Good afternoon, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations, AARP Oregon, here to support House Bill 22-24. I am not an expert related to the Interstate Compact. That's why I sent this bill back to our national office to be reviewed by individuals who are familiar with the compact. And we're obviously very concerned about consumer protection. We've been following this as it developed, and many of our questions over the past couple of years have been answered. Of course, as Joel indicated, the compact has just become operational. There are still perhaps one or two questions to be answered. And with that in mind, the word I got back from our national office that they thought this bill was a very reasonable approach to take. And with that in mind, again, we support the legislation, and I hope you don't have any questions for me.
Well, Rick, if you could tell us what AARP stands for, that would be good. How's that?
Actually, it stands for a great many things, but it's just AARP. And it stands for community service and advocacy and education.
Okay, I guess.
CSA.
I guess I'll let you off the hook with that.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions from the committee?
He represents me, so.
All right, with that and seeing anybody else in the audience who would like to testify on House Bill 2224? Seeing none, I would like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2224 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2113. Steve, could you give us a brief summary of House Bill 2113?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2113 allows property owners to obtain a disallowance of supplier liens for materials, equipment, labor, or services if the owner has already paid the original contractor for those services and materials that are the basis of a lien against the property.
Thank you. And if we could have Craig Smith and Bill Boyd from the Construction Contractors Board come forward.
Home away from home.
Seemingly so. Chair Hulvey and members of the committee, it's Craig Smith again with the Construction Contractors Board with Bill Boyd concerning House Bill 2113. This is one of Construction Contractors Board pre-session filed bills. It has to do with construction liens, which is a complicated topic. What I planned on doing today, with your permission, is to do an overview of the written testimony that we have before you so you know what's there, talk a little bit about the nature of the problem, the proposed solution in this bill, and then Mr. Boyd, with your permission, will go through the details of the bill, talk about some consumer complaints that we've received that suggest that this solution may be reasonable, and then obviously open it up for any questions you may have. What we have in front of you, of course, is an executive summary on the first page. The next page and a half talks a little bit more detailed about the bill and the problem. Pages 4 and 5 will tell you a little bit about the Construction Contractors Board and its programs in general. And then the next pages talk about the Construction Contractors Board claims process or the dispute resolution process that often handles claims of this nature. There is a fact sheet about the Construction Contractors Board on page 8 and 9. One of the important documents that has to do with this lien law is a CCB written document entitled Information Notice to Owner About Construction Liens. We've had a hearing regarding that matter, a little bit about that particular notice. That was House Bill 2120. So you'll see that document. It'll look familiar to you. Another document that affects this particular lien situation is the Notice of Right to Lien. That's on page 12. And I'll be telling you a little bit more about that. That is the product that the sub or supplier provides to the homeowner and lets them know a little bit about their exposure or their risk whenever they're providing labor and materials on a project. Page number 14 and 15 through 16 is Bill's memo to me regarding this matter. And then page 17, we'll talk a little bit about Bill Will. This is a list of losses by consumers over the last few years. And we think it's important for you to see the extent of the problem. About 1% of the complaints that the Construction Contractors Board receives
involve this pay twice problem. And this, of course, is a short list. I don't mean it to be a complete list of the last 2 years of problems, but it gives you some idea of the nature of what's happening in consumers. We have developed a PowerPoint presentation. I won't go through that unless you want me to later, that talks a little bit about Oregon's lien law. That is pages 19 through 47. To go back to the beginning then, the purpose of this bill is to protect consumers or to extend additional protection. Probably for the last 25 years, the Construction Contractors Board has been dealing with this issue. It was about 1982 that members of the Construction Contractors Board and consumers appeared before this body to first suggest to you that this problem needs to be rectified. And the then Builders Board suggested to you a fix that was very similar to the one that's proposed today. This is a simple fix, and I can tell you that the Assembly at that time was rather receptive to the Builders Board, but didn't go as far as this bill. Instead, they went as far as a notice. The notice is the information notice to owner about construction liens, a copy of which is contained as exhibit number 10, pages 10 and 11. Contractors are obligated to provide that document when they enter into a contract with a consumer. And they often provide it, but not always. Probably worse than the fact that it's not always provided is the fact that it's not always read. And the Oregon lien law, and I would dare say lien laws in most states, are designed such to provide an interest for subs and suppliers to get paid. The problem is that that interest lies on the back of the consumer, and in some cases the consumer is obligated then to pay twice. It results when the consumer pays for their goods or services. The general contractor, for whatever reason, doesn't pay the material dealer or the subcontractor, and the material dealer or the subcontractor then tries to perfect their lien rights. This is a very scary time for consumers, and we have, over the years, heard from consumers over and over again asking, who's responsible for the lien law? Why is it written the way it is? And why doesn't the Construction Contractors Board at least recommend changes? So we bring this to you for your consideration. This would provide a complete defense for consumers if they can prove that they paid their general. It puts the collection issue on the back of the sub or suppliers. That's a fundamental change to Oregon lien law. It's very, very big. And I can't tell you that a lot of other states have embraced this. In fact, most other states have a similar law to Oregon's, and that is that consumers are at risk for paying twice. But, of course, we wonder why that is. And there have been arguments by opponents to this legislation in years past that have suggested that construction would grind to a halt, that lenders wouldn't lend funds, that subs wouldn't provide their services. But I can just tell you that that's not been my experience. In many cases, the subs or suppliers don't protect their lien rights. They don't provide the notices that they need to in order to protect their lien rights. And I just believe that, again, I think it's time that that Oregon take a look at this proposed solution again after about the last 25 years of setting it on the shelf. I should tell you that in 2003, then Representative Merkley attacked this problem with a vengeance. And he worked extremely hard with all the parties to try to come up with a solution. And it took a couple of years, but he was able to pass what's known as then the
Home Buyer Protection Act.
But it's not a complete cure. It certainly doesn't cure problems that involve custom homes, nor does it solve problems with remodeling when the remodeling is under $50,000. And as I say, we receive a significant number of complaints, and I think the major thing we bring to you is whether or not that's fair for consumers. I think that the public policy issue needs to balance the benefit consumers and others get from having the law as it is compared to the problems that it causes. And we believe that it causes more problems than it solves. With that said, I'd like to turn it over to Bill to go through a detailed analysis of the bill and talk about consumer problems.
Okay, on page 17 and 18,
if you could state your name.
Oh,
for
I'm
the record,
sorry.
Please.
I should know how to do this by now. Well, I get nervous for every one of these still. My name is Bill Boyd. I'm the manager of the dispute resolution section for the Construction Contractors Board. On page 17 and 18, we've listed for the last 3 years, the last three calendar years, the liens that have been completed processing during those years, and you'll find quite a list of them. I'm going to talk a little bit about the specifics of the top two on that list, but then you get far enough down, you get to a place where this is in order of shortfall, and on the second page of that list, we don't show a shortfall. Those are the cases where the bond was able to satisfy the lien, so there wasn't the consumer didn't have to pay anything. I want to point out that this is only the people that filed a claim with us. We believe that there's quite a few people that deal with these outside the CCB claim system. They just go ahead and bite the bullet and pay off the lien, and they're sort of stuck with it. That's because there are still many people in Oregon that don't know that we exist. As you know, we have another bill that's going to try to help that with the consumer notification. But there are lots of people that don't find out about us until it's too late. The top two of those are involving there was a James and Patricia. They contracted with Sapphire Homes to build them a new home in Bend. In March of 2001, they received a notice of right to lien from Tualatin Valley Builders Supply. Sapphire failed to pay building supply, and Tualatin Valley filed its lien in August of 2001, and they turned around and filed their CCB claim in the same month. They demonstrated that they had paid the almost $25,000 in lien payments and attorney fees. There was a settlement between the parties in this case. Sapphire filed bankruptcy, and its debts were discharged in 2004. That's why the big delay in processing or finishing off this claim. There were 19 other claims against Sapphire Homes, and so which James and Patricia had to share with these other 19 claims the payouts on this. And so their share of the bond was a little under $3,000, leaving them with almost $22,000 in lien payout that they had made. They had paid twice on that contract. The second example I have, Michael and Caroline, they contracted to have a two-story addition put on their home and construct a deck and re-roof their home. They hired Titan, and Titan hired Symmetry Construction to do part of the work. Symmetry gave a notice of right to lien in January of 2005. Titan failed to pay Symmetry, and Symmetry filed a lien on their home in October of 2005. They filed their CCB claim a month later. In March of 2006, Michael and Caroline paid Symmetry over $21,000 to release the lien, and we awarded them a final order of about a little over the same amount in May of that year. The CCB also awarded this Titan took a great big dive. We awarded them over $100,000 in breach of contract damages for negligent work. And they also had to share the $15,000 bond with two other owners. The bond paid a little over $2,200 toward their lien claim, leaving them owing almost $19,000. But they also lost another almost $90,000 on their breach of contract claims. So this was not a good job for them. I go through arguments in favor of the bill in the rest of the memo, and also responses to what we anticipate will be arguments in opposition in that as well. Now I'd like to go ahead and just step through the bill real quickly. On page the way that legislative council organizes these things normally is when they draft them is that they just kind of go straight through the ORS sections as they amend them, and so they're you'll find the actual guts of the bill later on, but I'm going to go ahead and just step through them in the same order they have them. Section 1 deals with the notice of right to lien. This is the notice that a material supplier or a subcontractor has to give the homeowner in order to have a right to lien at all. Well, the notice is worded that there would be a right to lien, but now they've changed the wording of the notice to reflect the fact that you can make a defense if you can show that you've paid, and you can defend yourself against the lien. So they've modified the wording in this notice, and that gets us all the way over to page 3 of the bill. This section, I'm going to track here. This section just has a real minor modification to change the subsections that are listed. It appears in on page 4 of the bill in on line 2. It changes 6 to a 7. Section 3, they made an addition in 87058 in line 5, just showing that that this section only applies to licensed contractors. This section really can only deal with licensed contractors because it deals with a process whereby a party can file with the CCB after the foreclosure action starts, and they can get the court to stay that foreclosure until the CCB gets done with their processing, so that if there is an award of a lien, that there will be money from the CCB bond available to pay off that lien to the extent that there's bonding money available at all. So that's sort of a technical area of the law that has to do with how the court process joins up with the CCB dispute resolution process. And then in Section 6, down at on line 37 of page 4, just is there to be sure that there isn't any confusion that the stay proceedings don't interfere with a person's right to seek disallowance of the lien. And so they've added that in there. The next page, Section 4, is where we actually get into the meat of the lien. That's on page 5 of your bill. And the first line on line 2 says, in a suit to enforce a lien perfected under ORS 87035, the court shall disallow the lien if the owner proves the owner paid the original contractor for materials, equipment, labor, or services. That is the guts of this bill. When we originally wrote this bill, I think that we had intended that we would confine this to residential owners, so that if we go forward with this, we would probably need to amend this bill if we want to confine it to residential owners. As it sits today, it would apply to both commercial and residential property. In the bottom of that page, there's a change that legislative council made. That wasn't a change we requested, but every time they get into one of these sections of the law, they try to rewrite the language so it's a little more modern than it has been in the past. The lien law is particularly ancient language. They've taken a sentence there, a very long sentence, and split it into three sentences. On page 6, the statute sets out the waiver of that's for the homeowner, what we call the Homeowner Protection Act, and that is now has to have the language modified to take into account that we're not saying that you will have you will lose money if a contractor is able to foreclose a lien. It just sort of adds in the fact that there's a defense that we're doing. Section 6 deals with what's called the information notice to homeowners. This is the notice that a contractor has to attach to a contract if the contract is for more than $1,000. And this is, notice is prepared by the CCB. That's required that this, I believe this is the one that has to be on 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper so that they can put it on the back of their contract if they wish to. And this warns a homeowner of the possibility of a lien and gives them some information as to where to get information as to how to avoid that and precautions they could take. This is the notice also that we think is very often not given out, but at any rate, there is some language changes that needed to be made here because now the law, if this bill gets adopted, then the law has changed, so the notices about the law have to also change, and that's what the changes in Section 6 are. The next section is just sets up the effective date of the Act. And that's it.
Thank you for walking us through this bill. Questions from the committee? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that you originally had meant this only for homeowners, and given the difference in procedures in homeowner and commercial and the outcomes, do you feel that this should just be for homeowners? Is it that your stand now?
Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, Bill has some comments. I want him to make those. But it's interesting because I've heard a little bit from some of the my colleagues in the industry that goes both ways on this. And I'd be interested in hearing what kind of testimony we get today. Perhaps if you're of a mind to move this particular piece of legislation, it might be good for the entire industry. At the very least, though, and this is where we get the complaints, it ought to apply to residential market.
That was pretty much what I was going to say, too. I've talked to a few people that have said that they would actually like to see it apply to commercial property as well because commercial general contractors don't have they don't get a right to notice of right to lien, and so they have no idea what their subs and their who they're hiring. They can try to monitor the job site, but on a complicated job site it's very difficult to do that. So they had asked for that at one time. I think I'm pretty sure that they'll be telling you that shortly. So this is one of those questions about the legislation that needs to be answered. I don't think there's a lot. There's a big difference between the process for filing a lien in commercial property and residential property, except for who gets those notices, and that is a big difference.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask Mr. Smith again to state what you said about the percentage of your complaints that are of this nature, and to clarify that it was residential.
Okay. Yes. Chair Holvey and Representative Gilliam, we receive about 1 to 2% of our breach of contract and negligent and improper complaints that have to do with this lien problem. So it's a small part of our dispute resolution program, but we believe we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg.
And Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, I suspect that that most of the commercial properties aren't filed through us, that they take those to court, or most commercial contracts have all sorts of dispute resolution processes that they just follow those instead of coming to us.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Thank you, men, for being here today. What is the, in addition to the lien amount, what are the fees and how are they established?
Mm-hmm. Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, I presume you're talking about the fee to file a complaint. Mm-hmm. Phil would be able to speak to that regarding both the court side and CCB.
The Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, the fees for us would be the $50 claim processing fee that gets charged if you file it with us. On the court side, I would suspect that most of these claims are not the kind of claims that fit into the lower cost lawsuits. It's probably going to be around $100 or $150 to file a lawsuit. to foreclose the lien. Then there's going to be some other additional charges and things tacked on. And then beyond that, the law specifies that the winner gets the other side's attorney fees, has to pay the other side's attorney. The winner gets attorney fees from the loser. So, and that's where one of the that's a pretty big ticket item usually on any substantial foreclosure.
Further questions from the committee? Craig, you had mentioned earlier in your testimony that most states operate under the current structure that Oregon has. Are there other states out there that have a different approach to this problem? And I guess what is that approach is the second part of that.
Chair Olvey and members of the committee, we didn't do an exhaustive search, but I did go out on the internet and put a couple of keywords and got back quite a bit of kind of a potpourri, if you will, about what other states do. Many other states use a notice the way we do, which is designed to make sure owners understand the risks that they bear when they enter into a construction contract with a contractor. Other states have a dedicated recovery fund that's for this kind of a problem. And then in the past, and I wasn't able to nail this right on, but I believe New York has a similar solution as we're proposing today.
Yeah, there was a survey of in 2005 of various states' lien laws, and they only allow a person to recover from the property owner the amount that remains unpaid on the contract on the date that the lien is filed. And so if you're a homeowner and you've paid in full already, then there's going to be no recovery allowed to subcontractors or other lienors. If you still owe, 25% of the project, well, that gives them some leeway to recover that.
So if this bill were to pass and be Oregon law, the recourse for the subcontractor, I mean the homeowner wouldn't have to pay twice, then in this scenario the subcontractor is left holding the bag, and the subcontractor has a contract with the general contractor, and his only recourse would be to take the general contractor to court unless the general contractor declares bankruptcy, and of course we know that he wouldn't get much out of that.
Chair Olvey and members of the committee, that's essentially right, but know this, that both the subs and suppliers can file claims with the Construction Contractors Board at little cost, $50 a pop. It's recoverable if they prevail, and that goes against the contractor's license as well as, and I'm talking about residential now, it goes against the contractor's license, so that if the contractor is found to owe the money, it's a fairly simple analysis at that point. The contractor's board will take that license away until that debt's paid. In addition, they have a small access to the CCB bond. So they don't necessarily need to go to court, and they do have some chance of recovering against the contractor's bond.
And Chair Holvey, the other thing is that your material supplier and the subcontractor usually have access to credit reports, which most homeowners don't have. The other thing that the person who is delivering these services is that they know how far in arrears the contractor that they're delivering the services are, whereas the homeowner has no way of knowing that. And as a matter of fact, I think that's true of the commercial property owner as well. So I've signed an order once for $200,000 from a lumber firm out in Oregon, in eastern Oregon, because they had run up allowed the contractor to run up a $200,000 debt. And I don't know how that happens, but it did. And you'd think that they would have shut the spigot off a little sooner than that. But as long as they can rely on the lien recovery, they don't really have a big incentive because they can always go against the property.
So, and I got one more follow-up before I turn it over to other members on the committee. So, in relationship to the dispute resolution charts that you gave us that list all these complainants who ended up short, so I would assume from your testimony that the contractors that shorted them, the CCB has taken their licenses away?
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, they would have had their license suspended if it was still active. And it oftentimes what happens is these folks go out of business or they file bankruptcy. If they file bankruptcy under current law, we're obligated to allow them to get a new license. But I can tell you that in most cases they fade away and they're not licensed any longer.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Smith and Mr. Boyd, please indulge me for a moment. I was afraid that maybe I got off track trying to listen and read at the same time. But in your written testimony on page 15, it says that the House Bill 2113 does not change the lien law with respect to non-residential property such as commercial property because owners of commercial property are considered more knowledgeable of the law and business practices and better able to protect their interests. But then I thought I heard you say that the way the bill is drafted, it does not make that exception. So am I missing something?
No, you're not. Representative Holvey, Representative Bonamici, I wrote that, and I have to say, I guess what I want to ask you is to listen to what I say and not what I write, because I made a mistake there. When I wrote this, I hadn't looked at the amendment we had requested and noticed that we were requesting it to go to the residential, that the actual bill says all property.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you.
Can I just ask?
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. This is so simple, you probably think I'm about third grade. Maybe fourth. No. Why don't we just write in the payee, the contractor's name, and the subs? I mean, without having to go through all this. Why don't we just make that a practice?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, what I'm hearing you say is why does the owner isn't required to pay both the sub and the general at the same time? Right. And of course, we do recommend that. But in some cases, there are a lot of subs and a lot of different suppliers. The less sophisticated consumer, it's difficult to do. It's difficult to write that two-party check or two-payee check. And I guess it's been our experience that in most cases, again, the problem is that consumers, they believe they're protected by CCB and the bond. They believe that the contractor is going to do what they say it's going to do. And then when everything all goes to pot, it's a very, very sad day. I think you may hear from a consumer when that occurs a little bit later.
Representative Nelson, also there are often layers of this, that you have a general contractor who hires a sub who then may buy material from several different material suppliers. They may rent some equipment. It can get, even a small job can get quite, that list would be quite long and complicated. And I think a lot of homeowners, what they want to do is hire one general contractor and turn the whole thing over to them and have them do the right thing and get it done and not bother them with all of this administrative detail of who has to get paid what.
Right. Thank you. Question, Representative Riley.
Just a comment, I guess. If a homeowner had to do all of these minutiae and pay each subcontractor and supplier, then all the general contractors would be out of business. There's no point to have a general contractor at that point.
Well, I get a license.
Yeah, I know you would argue with that, but I'm still giving it straight.
Don't I need a license, Rep Riley?
Let's not go there. Never mind.
Further questions or comments from the committee? Seeing none, thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
For your testimony and enlightening on this, enlightening us on this proposal of a pretty complicated issue. Next up, I'd like to call Jessica Adamson.
Don't beat me up.
Jessica, if you could state your name, which I know you're going to do, and who you're representing, and telling us your position on this and why.
Sure. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors representing the commercial side of the industry. And we aren't here to necessarily beat up on this issue today, and welcome to the very complicated, complex world of lien law. It's really a lot of fun, and we enjoy it a lot. This pay-twice situation isn't unique to the residential industry, and it's something that is difficult not only for the owner, but for the general contractor as well. On the commercial side of the industry, our contracts are such so that if there is a lien against the property, the general contractor is held responsible. So it's not the owner that is often left holding the bag unless the general contractor goes bankrupt. It is the general contractor that's held responsible. And again, we're held responsible whether we've already paid the debt or the bill or not. The reason why liens occur isn't because a solvent contractor hasn't paid their bills. It's because somebody is going bankrupt, at least most often. It's a rare instance where you have a solvent contractor who isn't paying their bills. It's because somebody's in financial trouble. They've gotten extended 60, 90, 120 days with their suppliers. They're using one payment to pay bills on another job. It's really usually quite a mess. And when somebody, a subcontractor, fails, there isn't just one job that is impacted. It's a whole slew of them. And by the time they get to that point, it is a disaster for everyone involved. It's a mess for the current job. It's a mess for the others. It's a pain for everybody. On the commercial side, we have been looking at this issue for a long time. And one of the big problems that we face is that often we have not only the general contractor, and then we have first-tier subs, sometimes second-tier, even third-tier subcontractors, all of whom have relationships with their suppliers. The supplier knows what the credit standing is of that subcontractor, or for that matter, the general contractor. They know how many pieces of equipment they've rented. They know how short or long it's been since their last payment. They know what the credit is. We don't. We often have no idea who those subcontractors have in terms of suppliers, who's on the job. And in third-tier subcontractor situations, we may not even know who those folks are. Certainly not that they have equipment on our job and who that equipment belongs to. If it doesn't have a sticker on the side saying Star Rentals, we don't know, and we don't know where that is. So we're left in the awkward position of where we pay our first-tier subcontractors, and they pay their subcontractors, and if it gets down and they haven't paid their suppliers, we don't know until it's too late, until the job is nearly complete, and then all of a sudden, oop, there's a lien. If we had known that there was a problem or that there was issues in the industry, we could have used what Representative Nelson just referred to as a joint check, and we would have issued it to the first tier and then to the sub-tier. Believe me, they don't think that that's really neat, but it's our way of protecting ourselves and the owner to make sure that folks get paid. Unfortunately, state law does not allow us to require that notices of potential right to lien go to the general contractor. They are only required to go to the owner. And we have, in several legislative sessions in years past, argued that we also need those to go to the general contractor so that we can protect ourselves and the owner in the event that there is a problem. So we know who's there. We know who's got an interest on our job. So that is, again, if you're looking to extend this to the commercial side, we would argue first that this should extend to us. Anybody who pays once shouldn't be expected to pay twice, and that should extend up and down the line. That shouldn't just be left at the owner. The general contractor can prove that they've paid. They shouldn't be left holding the bag, and so on and so forth. I understand that wouldn't always be popular with our subcontractor friends and not necessarily with our supplier friends. But as a matter of fairness, there is that issue. if not possible, secondarily, to extend and fix this problem so that general contractors can have the notice of potential right to lien. So we know who's there. We can keep an eye on it. If we hear rumor in the industry that there's an issue, we know who to go to. If the suppliers have to send us the notice of potential right to lien, you better believe that when someone gets 60 or 90 days out, that they'll probably pick up the phone and call us and say, hey, I haven't seen any money from this person relative to the order they made for your job. That can enable us to start making that right sooner rather than later, because once the job's finished, once that subcontractor is off the job, we've already given them the retainage that we withheld. There is no lever on our part to get them to do the right thing, and we're left holding the bag. So from the commercial side, we aren't necessarily opposed to this legislation, but we do believe that if you're going to go down this road of applying it on the commercial side, that it should be applied up and down the line, or we should look at notices of right to lien. Because, again, we can't make things right if we don't know. Now, the law does allow us to require lien releases from our subcontractors. But, again, those are our first-tier subcontractors, and we may say to them, hey, we want to make sure that you got those lien releases from your folks. But there's no way for us to verify if that is or is not the case. And if someone hasn't provided it, despite the fact that we've got that from a first-tier subcontractor, that paper isn't really worth the writing that it's on. I mean, it's not worth anything. They still can perfect that lien right, and it doesn't help us in the slightest. So, again, I think what you're hearing from us is sympathy with the owners that are in that position, but we submit that we have often found ourselves in the same position, and often because we just simply don't know who's out there, despite our best efforts. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
To further confuse lien law, from a different perspective, any questions from the committee? Well, Jessica, you certainly cast a different light on this particular bill when we're looking at this, and primarily, you know, from the CCB's point of view, from the residential industry, and you've cast a light on how it is different in the commercial industry at many times, being that it's the general contractor who's left holding the bag and not the homeowner or the owner necessarily. So. I think that testimony was gives us something to reflect on how really complicated this law is in the different industries we are looking at. So I appreciate that, and hope you stay tuned to this particular bill as it tends to move through this process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I wish you the best of luck as you delve into this issue.
Thank you. We may need some. Next up, I'd like to call Dana
Nishimura.
Hopefully I got that right.
Nishimura. Well, I'm novice at this.
Well, don't let that stop you.
It didn't when I testified before Senator Prozanski at last year's legislative interim hearings. So.
Great. If you would just identify yourself for the record.
Chairman Halsey and members of the committee, I'm Dana Nishimura. I am a member of the public. I'm a homeowner who, in recent years, hired a remodeling contractor and was left with means. I came here today representing not only myself, but a group of homeowners I came to know because I went out and I found them. All customers of the same crooked remodeling contractor, who in this case is that rare exception of a guy who was solvent but was running a scam using the unpaid bills and lien process to rake in money for personal gain. I came here today in support of House Bill 2113, and I hope that it will provide desperately needed protection for these honest customers, the homeowners I met, and also subs and suppliers that I found and met and came to know. We need protection from this crooked contractor and others who choose not to pay their suppliers and keep that money for personal gain. As your lien law now exists, it's too easy for an unscrupulous contractor to outmaneuver and evade protective measures. It's too easy to enrich himself at the consumer's expense, knowing he personally will face little or nothing in the way of consequences for his fraudulent actions. The scenario I'll present of our corrupt contractor, for our group of homeowners who suffered horrific financial damage, isn't imaginary. Craig Smith and Bill Boyd, whom I've also met and come to know right here behind me, they know Wade McGilvra very well. Wade was written up extensively in the Oregonian newspaper article, "Licensed, Bonded, and Unaccountable." Mr. McGilvra habitually abandoned supplier bills at the end of his remodeling projects, leaving us facing those frightening threats of liens. After receiving multiple complaints against McGilvra, primarily 2003 through 2005, the CCB refused and revoked McGilvra's two licenses. I've provided a compilation of all the CCB complaints against McGilvra, but this list of money, the stolen money, falls short of the true totals because it doesn't include the numerous civil lawsuits and judgments against McGilvra. I researched those too. I personally believe the dollar amount of money he scammed from his customers and suppliers alike over the years is far higher because I've called, visited, and come to know many of his former customers, subcontractors, and suppliers. I've heard their stories and financial loss. I've provided copies of comments, too, from some of the homeowners in our group who couldn't be present. I'd like to briefly illustrate the extent of financial damage our dishonest contractor caused just three of his customers. And one of them is referenced here in the CCB's paperwork on their chart on page 17. Scott and Nancy Priest, the third from the top. And I would like to point out that this isn't wholly correct, and it's nothing that the CCB's done wrong. But the information you don't have before you is that Nancy and Scott Priest were left with $77,000 in two liens, about $19,000 from Trinity Carpet, about $58,000 from Hayes Cabinet. Wade McGilvra did not pay those bills. Hayes Cabinet subsequently brought the Priests to trial in their attempts to collect from the lien, but unfortunately had their lien dismissed. So that amount isn't reflected here. Hayes Cabinet is not only out of pocket the $58,000 for their cabinet supplies, but another $50,000 in attorney fees, and that I learned from Tammy Lilly, their chief financial officer. Roy and Christine Weidman, who are now dear friends of mine, contractor McGilvra left them facing approximately $95,000 in unpaid bills and subsequent liens. The lawsuit they filed over 4 years ago is still in progress. The Weidmans have paid over $50,000 in attorney fees, and their ongoing adversary complaint to McGilvra's bankruptcy petition continues to raise those attorney fees. There were other costly issues in their case, but in just this example, McGilvra, a dishonest contractor, has cost the Weidmans over $145,000 beyond their original project costs. That's staggering. I couldn't handle it if it were me. I'd be dead in the water. Norma and Damon McCauley, McGilvra left them facing $22,000 in liens, Trinity Carpet and Standard TV and Appliance. To date, I believe their attorney fees approach $11,000. Nancy and Scott Priest, I've just discussed with Hayes Cabinet and Trinity Carpet. Cumulatively, just these three homeowners were forced to pay an additional $275,000, about $200,000 of which went directly into McGilvra's own pockets. Note that McGilvra's many cheated customers are forced to endure the financial losses because we could not afford the additional expense of a legal chase. And this presents a disturbing fact. McGilvra and other crooked contractors like him, raking a lot of easy money. I'm one of those who couldn't afford the expensive legal case. We just ate it. We had no choice. And I'm among the least financially damaged of this entire group that I've met.
All right.
But I was so deeply offended that this man did this to me. I set out that week to warn other homeowners, and I just kept hearing these horror stories, so I just kept making notes because I went to every legal source I could think of for help. I've been to speak to deputies. I've written to district attorneys, to Governor Kulongoski, to the Attorney General. I've written more letters than I could tell you. I made Wade McGilvera just about my full-time job for the past year and a half. I was told, the very first deputy I sat down with, I was told, we can't do anything about it unless you can show a pattern, because that proves intent to defraud. Well, I've shown that pattern over and over in spades. It hasn't made a lot of difference yet, but I think that your bill can make a difference. The term pay-twice dilemma is misleading. The reality is that we victimized customers pay many, many more times than merely twice. To the list you have before you, I've added, which I forgot to note in there, that we also pay fees to renew permits the contractor allows to lapse. Now, we have to pay others to complete the unfinished work when the suppliers and subcontractors won't come back and finish it because he hasn't paid them yet. And even if we homeowners obtain a favorable judgment after an expensive legal chase, we pay still more in an attempt to collect on that judgment. So we don't pay just twice. Customers are repeatedly advised to be smart, do research, hire wisely. But I assert that all our fervent efforts and all the good advice provided in the consumer notices will not protect us when that crooked contractor decides at the end to leave without paying the suppliers. Why are we so vulnerable? This part's really important because it's commonplace business practice to require the homeowners to pay the general contractor directly, since remodelers and builder contracts stipulate he's responsible to pay the suppliers, subs for labors and materials. That's what my contract said. My contract offered all sorts of pretty guarantees. He won't allow any liens to come against us. My contract also had written into it that we were only to make checks payable to him. And I believe that's directly contrary to the consumer right to lien notice. It says, well, we have the right. So these contractors outsmart us. It's commonplace business practice for subs and suppliers to bill the general contractor in the months following the work. So I've got my contractor requiring me to make monthly installments, and if I'm late, I'm making an 18% charge on that late payment too. So I don't want to be late. But he's not even been billed by the supplier yet. I'm making March, April, May payments. They're not going to bill him until June, July, and August. Too late. I'm out the money. He's in possession of it, but I get the lien? It's commonplace business practice for remodeler and builder contracts leaving the homeowner withholding only minor sums, typically several hundred dollars, to ensure a punch list completion. These modest sums can't help a consumer when the contractor chooses not to pay the last supplier bills. He paid the initial suppliers, the ones who come in at the beginning, because he needs the project to get moving. He needs your house to get torn up. He needs you to be left with no choice but to continue. Then, at the end, he just doesn't finish paying them, but those amounts can be tens of thousands of dollars, and we don't know it. The unpaid supplier is usually successful in obtaining payment under the threat of lien foreclosure upon the homeowner. Ironically, it's also commonplace business practice that once the supplier obtains a payment, his bill is satisfied and the supplier continues to extend credit and do repeat business with the same contractor, who then continues to scam on one unsuspecting homeowner after another. This is what Wade McGilvera did to us. us meaning the whole group of homeowners, I came to know, and there's a good three dozen of us. The general contractor has all the power in these situations. Really, he calls the shots. We're forced to pay up, and it enables him to pocket the money and walk away, breaching his contractual obligations to pay his suppliers. At this point, the homeowner, the consumer, is still victimized, still swindled, and most unreasonably, still legally cornered into a financially ruinous situation we didn't create. We honored our contract. Are we only safe if we can outsmart him, McGilfra, or other crooked contractors like him? Or are there other measures the law can take to hold the crooked contractor accountable without penalizing the victim? As your lien law currently exists, an unpaid sub-supplier may obtain payment directly from the homeowner under that threat of foreclosure upon their home, despite the fact we can provide proof of payment to the general contractor. And as a lien law currently exists, it's too easy for him to skip paying them, pocket our money, and skip off with little or nothing in the way of repercussions. What happened to our homeowners? Please do require us to provide proof that we paid him. We'll be happy to comply. The same proof of payment in the form of bank process checks the contractor cashed will verify where the money's gone, into the bank account pockets of the dishonest contractor who should be held liable to pay the suppliers. House Bill 2113 appears to recognize that consumers are honest beings quite willing to pay for the construction we contracted to improve our living conditions. The bill appears to recognize that consumers, subcontractors, and suppliers alike should not be forced to incur extensive financial losses because of the crooked contractor's actions, leaving the bill unpaid. If House Bill 2113 is passed into law, it would give better protection to the honest consumers who can provide proof of full payment for labor and materials and has the potential to redirect demand for payment where it rightfully belongs, placing pressure on the dishonest contractor who accepted the homeowner's money yet withheld payment from subs and suppliers, often for his own personal enrichment. I don't want to leave suppliers unpaid. I don't want to leave them with nowhere to go. I just want to point out they should redirect their attention to the source, the person holding the payment. And I have additional comments, but I think I should give you a chance to ask me any questions.
Well, thank you so much for your testimony. And, you know, you have really brought to light why the CCB and why this committee is looking at this bill. This is unconscionable that a contractor like this can continue to operate in our state over the what looks like many years and repeating this scam, as you so aptly referred to it, time and time again. And this is an issue that this committee really needs to try to wrap its hands around and try to think through this and all its implications, because it is very complex. But at the end of the day, we're here to really try to protect the consumer in this effort. And this is a complicated issue, and our hour is very short. This will not be the last time that we address this particular bill or this particular issue in some other bill, as I know we have a couple of bills that are addressing this same issue, but this committee is going to be tackling this in either this bill or another bill like it from the task force, the claims task force recommendations. And I know the hour is late. I have enough time for maybe one question if somebody from the committee, Representative Riley. It seems like I look to the right, your hand's always up. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be require an answer from the CCB, I'm not sure. But what I'm concerned about is how the homeowner or the general contractor in the commercial field proves that they paid for that particular bill. Yes, you have all your receipts, your check stubs that say, I gave this much money to the general contractor. Right. What stops the general contractor from coming back and saying, oh, but that wasn't for that bill? This didn't cover the supplies that my subcontractor bought. That was something else. What's to stop that, and how do you prove that you've made that payment? Well, could you maybe come up and help? I that one bothers me a bit.
Thank you.
And we'll give you two chances at this, too, so, you know.
Okay.
Keep that in mind.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, and Representative Riley, I hear your question to me, how would the owner prove payment? And the bill does not go into that. It tries to just get to the public issue of the public policy issue of if they can prove it, will you let them off the hook? If we could start there, perhaps if in a court's eyes the owner in this case was successful in proving payment, then the lien would be able to be satisfied, at least from the owner's standpoint. Methods of proof of payment, of course, would there's all kinds of them. Progress payments. There would be checks that would say for this certain work. More complicated, larger construction projects would have draws that would indicate what the payment was for from the bank. So I can in my mind's eye I can see some problem there. But like I say, if you could get past the issue of do you think it's a good idea in general, maybe we can talk about some rules that could achieve that goal.
Thank you very much.
And might I offer that if the homeowner had paid the entire contract price for the project, you would assume that all the pieces of that project were paid for? That'd be pretty simple, I would think. But it doesn't cover the exact portions of that Representative Riley might have been referring. But I really appreciate you coming forward and Ms. Nishimura.
Yes.
And appreciate your testimony because it gives us the consumer point of view to this issue, which is a very, very important one to this committee. With that, I thank you very much for your testimony, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2113. And seeing the time is short, any comments from anybody? I want to publicly recognize Representative Girard for sitting in on this committee today, and we hope that he will be here permanently in the very near future. With that, I would like to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection. Thank you very much.
Thank you.